Judy Zemanek sent us an email.
Is it okay?
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, good.
I love emails from listeners.
Sorry, do you know who that is?
Yeah. Okay. Well, she introduced herself in her email.
Oh, good. You haven't met her? I can't remember.
I don't think I've met her.
No. Yeah, sorry. She texted me and said she couldn't get the email to work.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, she sent... Yeah, I think she sent me the same email twice, but it went into our spam for some reason. So.
Oh, I see.
And then I just happened to be looking in the spam today, and then I saw it, and I was like, whoa, there's an email in here.
Whoa.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sotheby. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Shale.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it, no matter the weather.
I like winter as much as the next guy. It was a slow start. We had a very mild fall, but It's been basically below 20 for 3 weeks, I think.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get outside with the kids. I'll take them into the yard and we'll build a fort or whatever, but really they don't want to be out there more than 20 minutes.
Yeah.
We've only been able to go sliding a few times this year just because it's been so cold. Sorry, sledding. Lisa always makes fun. I call it sliding. I don't know.
Oh, really?
Instead of sledding, but...
In Canada, we call it tobogganing, Alan.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I feel like the reason I call it sliding is because I think to myself, well, it's not sledding if you're not doing it on a sled. But I think if you're doing it on something that doesn't have runners, you're not really sledding. But
oh, I see what you mean. But I think that's a little pedantic, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But sliding sounds fun.
Yeah, totally. Sure does. But sliding also sounds like you might just be doing it in your snowsuit with no
That's true. Oh man, it was so when was that? In early December in Edmonton, it was so icy. We had got freezing rain days in a row. Mm-hmm. And we went sliding. we went to a park in near Mill Creek Ravine. And Cora was just sliding down this ice, terrifying icy slope in her snowsuit and laughing all the way. And
That does sound terrifying.
Yeah. So maybe I'll reserve the term sliding for something like that. It's like doing a skeleton with no, whatever the contraption is they ride on the skeleton.
Yeah. What is that called? A skeleton?
I don't know. I think maybe she wasn't face first most of it, but sometimes she couldn't control whether she was face first or not.
I believe it. It's just sheer ice everywhere.
Yeah. It's a cliche, but we walk Cora to school in the mornings when there's school. And we absolutely literally without any difficulty could have skated to school. Without any patches of we have to walk our skates.
Walk on this part. Yeah.
Skate portage across this concrete. No, it was all ice.
So crazy.
And smooth, yeah.
Cross country skiing though. That would be fun.
Yeah, that's something we did too when I was growing up. And it's also something that, I don't know if this happens all through the city. I assume it does. But in our neighborhood, whenever there's more than a few inches of fresh snow, there'll always be a few old timers who just do laps cross-country skiing in the park and down the city streets and stuff. I want to get into that. That's one of my retirement goals.
Yeah.
Is to be that
I'm
guy.
Thinking about it. Yeah. I don't know, Well, I think that there are great skiing trails in the city, or I don't know mm-hmm. how well maintained they are or whatever, but I'm sure that there's some good places to actually go and ski and not just do laps in the park that's up the block or whatever. But yeah, I was thinking it would be fun to have some winter camping gear. And if it was not minus 30 out, obviously, if it was minus 7 or
right.
10, yep. How about that?
Yep.
To be able to ski a couple miles in some place and set up a tent. And I think that would be super fun.
In the city, you mean, or?
No, outside the city.
Actual camping.
Actual camping.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that would be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen for me this year, but maybe next year. And most of the scary animals are hibernating in the winter and the bugs. So that's kind of nice.
you always got the silver linings. That's right. No bugs. It's minus. It was minus 27 last week, but there was not a mosquito.
There were no
to be
bugs.
Seen.
Yeah, I didn't even get bit by a single mosquito. Bring a little stove. Do a little camp cooking. Yeah. So this is a podcast. Just kidding. I'm cutting that out. So hey, Alan, how you been doing?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Holiday mode is turned off now.
Yeah, this is our no longer. This is our first like non-holiday party episode in a while, and consequently, I just have some sparkling water here instead of straight tequila. Or whatever I was drinking last time.
Oh, yeah. Although you did say that you wanted to touch on New Year's resolutions tonight, didn't you?
It's true. We do have some follow up.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. It's kind of funny that the way you put it makes it sound like I have some.
Oh, okay. You just wanted to rail against them.
Mostly, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. How do you feel about New Year's resolutions, Alan?
Like the common idea of them, like I'm not into, I don't set typical, New Year's resolutions for myself, but I am pretty big into goal setting.
Yeah.
And so we do usually, like some historically on New Year's morning, Lisa and I will like make our goals and plans for the year. It's not usually I'm going to work out twice a week or I'm going that kind of thing. Although yeah. there are like health and wellness goals, but we try to do them, make them as realistic and actionable and make a plan for them. Financial right. goals, goals for the home, goals for the kids and just stuff we want to do that year.
Take a look back at your like previous years kind of like yeah. goals and see like where are we at? Have we, you know, are we in the place that we thought that we would be? Do we need to continue pushing at some of these goals or,
yep.
you know, like extend some of them or whatever? Mm-hmm. Yeah. What you're talking about is like the, you know, is what I think is like totally reasonable.
Mm-hmm. What's unreasonable, Shay?
What's unreasonable is thinking that if there's something about yourself that you want to change, or something about your activities or, you know, the way you're doing things that you want to change, I mean, obviously, if you want to change something about yourself, at some point you have to decide to do it and then do it. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's like a social construct or some kind of culture around, you know, New Year's being a time to kind of reflect on the cycle of the year or whatever. And that makes right. sense. Mm-hmm. But I just, you know, personally think that it's silly to think that like, you know, if I wasn't able to quit smoking yesterday,
right?
Today, because it's a new year, I don't see how that changes anything, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And so I think goal setting is great. And I think looking back at the year is great. I think maybe even being nostalgic about like the past year or some other years is like all good. But I think like, mm-hmm. you know, resolutions, like I'm going to totally... You know, I'm good. You know, today's the day I'm no longer gonna. I don't know.
You mean like you're hungover from New Year's Eve, so you're exactly. not likely gonna stop drinking for the rest of your life that next morning. Is that what you mean?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
I think yeah, that's not for
most
people.
If anything, I think it's like, you know, leading up to the holidays and leading up to New Year's, it's like almost an excuse to not. Be disciplined about the things that you normally think that you would want to, because
yeah.
you know, you're like, oh, well, you know, New Year's is coming, and then I can make a resolution about this thing that I know that right. I shouldn't be doing to myself.
Right.
You know.
I'm sure there
so
are
people. So
that's
what I don't like about them.
Yeah. For but. Maybe there are people who can do that, but I think most people, you're not setting yourself up for success if you just make the resolution. Like for me, like say in terms of like activity and physical fitness, like I couldn't say like I'm gonna go to the gym twice a week,
right?
Because that just wouldn't last. Just say like just the time commitment, like there would be some time crunch and I wouldn't go, and then I'd feel like, oh, I've broken the resolution, so what's the point? But like,
yeah exactly,
for me I have to like really carefully think about how to kind of integrate that physical activity into my regular life in a realistic way. And so like in the past, it's like, even though I own a car, like I'm going to buy a bus pass and I'm going to take the bus every day, and that will have me walking 20 blocks, or like depending right. on where I'm working, like I'm riding my bike to work every day. And I enjoy riding the bike. So that, but it's like, instead of going to work, working, coming home, and then like going on the elliptical, it's like,
totally.
It's built into my
integrate
day.
Integrate it into your day. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the only success I've had really almost of any kind is when I have that kind of integrated approach to it.
Right. Yeah. And I think like, you know, if you're leading up to New Year's, like planning a way to integrate some holistic, like, you know, change into your life to benefit yourself somehow, like that's a different thing. Like that's like the kind of long-term goal setting that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that if you wake up on New Year's and you're going to be like, oh yeah, I'm a changed human today, like
right.
it's usually not very realistic, and most people I think wind up breaking their resolutions and then feeling let down by themselves, and then
the cycle continues.
Yeah. So that being said, I have no resolutions.
But okay, I know you're a big CGP Grey guy, right?
Right.
You've seen his video on New Year's resolutions?
Is it fairly new?
No. Or I would have watched it probably 3 or 4 years ago.
Like, yeah, I'm sure I probably have seen it. I know a lot about CGP Grey's style of goal setting.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, then I won't. I'll just change the subject.
No, and that's kind of what I'm thinking. You know, like you set like broader kinds of contexts for what you want to accomplish in a year, yes. and things like that, you know.
He that's exactly right. He suggests instead of making a set of resolutions, pick a theme for the year.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what some of the examples would be, but like say adventure or creativity or
totally
something like that.
Yeah. And he has a podcast with another podcaster that I listen to. His name's Mike Hurley. Their podcast is called Cortex. And they talk a lot about this type of stuff, like goal setting. And it's like the podcast itself is kind of about like productivity and motivation or something.
Oh,
but
really?
Not in a motivational speaker kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they over the past couple of years, they've developed this thing called the Theme Journal.
Okay.
And it's like just a little notebook, but it has like room in it for you to put your yearly theme in.
Mm-hmm.
And then some ways that they suggest that you structure the journal to, you know, be able to check in with yourself about your theme every so often and stuff
okay.
like that.
Yeah.
But I actually ordered one this year. They've had it for a couple of years and I didn't order one previously, but I ordered one this year.
Yeah.
And planning on using it to set a yearly theme for myself, which mm-hmm. I haven't done yet, but.
Cool.
Pretty excited.
Mm.
Mike Hurley's a big pen guy too, and I bought a pen that he recommended as well, along with my paper journal. Yeah.
I'm
not a crazy expensive pen or anything, but
I'm actually shocked to hear you say that you have purchased
a paper notebook. Yeah. I know it's not really my style. Yeah, most of what I do, I try to like keep digital so that I can have it like on all my devices and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and get at things that I want to get at wherever I am and mm-hmm. from whatever device I'm using. But in the last year, I've been spending more time in my studio here, like studio slash home office. And I mean, it's great because I'm in front of my computer and I can, you know, definitely like do things like input things digitally all the time. I don't want this to turn into a productivity podcast, so I'll make this quick. But a few times I've noticed that, you know, like if I'm on a call or something like that and I quickly need to jot something down, it would just be nice to have a notebook, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't exactly know all like what I'm going to try and make the purpose be for the notebook yet, but I'm going to try and, you know, like pick something to do in the notebook that only goes in the notebook and, you know, like, I mean, or like goes in the notebook first and then potentially gets transcribed or scanned or something like that. But you know, anyways, no resolutions, but I am going to set a theme.
Okay.
If anyone wants to know what it is, write in.
They'll have to write in to ask and you'll respond.
I bring it up on the podcast again, we're going to be talking about productivity again food.
Yeah, so, instead of food. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Any other follow up?
Yeah. A couple things. Oh, yeah. So, on the subject of New Year's resolutions, since the last time we spoke, I spoke to you about this last night, but since the last time we recorded a podcast, I spoke to my doctor, and apparently now, the episode after I talked all about my diabetes, I am officially no longer type 2 diabetic. So that's great news.
Yeah.
And what that has to do with New Year's resolutions is basically absolutely nothing. I'm changing nothing. I'm going to continue to eat in the way that I have been eating and exercise in the way that I have been exercising.
Since your type 2 diagnosis, not...
Yeah, since my diagnosis.
Yeah.
And the whole point of the change that I made when I got that diagnosis was to try and do it in a way that was going to be like sustainable. And I feel like it has been very sustainable, and I feel like I can sustain it. And I feel much healthier than I did a year ago, and I want to continue down that path. And so nothing there is changing.
Awesome.
Yeah. And also somewhat related... We got an email from a listener. I think you may know this person, Alan.
Oh yeah.
Her name is Judy Zemanek.
Yep.
Ever heard of her?
Yeah, Judy Zemanek is my mother-in-law.
Right.
Yeah.
And she said basically, well, I was considering reading the email, but it's maybe a little too long to read out the whole thing. But basically, what she said was that, after hearing me talk about, my, low carb diet, she thought it would be a nice gesture to send home some low carb baked goods, for
oh,
me
really? Oh,
after,
cool.
yeah, after you visited, this Christmas, but then it didn't quite work out. In terms of the baking, I think she said, and so
okay,
yeah. So unfortunately, that didn't happen. Although, totally appreciate the gesture. Mm-hmm. Maybe next year. And then she also sent me a bunch of information about some YouTubers that she's been watching and some blogs that she's been looking at that are like doing keto related stuff and low carb related stuff. And yeah, some of this information looks really good. I haven't followed up on much of it so far. But thanks a lot, Judy. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, she's like a low carb expert. And I don't think I literally scoffed or rolled my eyes when she told us probably a couple years ago now that she was doing the keto diet, because it seemed like not everybody that I knew, but a lot of people were doing it.
Right.
And generally, you know that most of them won't stay with it, which is not a nice thing to say. But
well, and I've definitely scoffed at people who were, you know, telling me that they were going to get on the keto diet. You know,
but she absolutely
both because of my own ignorance about it and stuff, like in terms of the health benefit and stuff like that, and also just because it seemed like such a fad diet.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, she's been doing it, I think, for 2 years now, and has had amazing results, and yeah, she's done very well.
That's awesome. She also pointed out that Love Pizza has like a low carb pizza crust, and I actually knew that already, and I have had one of those during my that was like sort of a cheat for me one time, was to order a low carb pizza from Love Pizza. But
okay, and it was good. Yeah,
and it was good. I mean, you know, it's just not the same though. You know, like it's never going to be the same as like, you know, actually eating like a really good Neapolitan margarita pizza or something like that.
Yes.
You know? But
yeah.
But yeah, there's options. And that, like, I don't know if maybe her email was in response to me sounding like I felt deprived of things or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you know, it's like I do feel deprived of things to some extent, but sort of in a fun way, you know, like I don't really feel deprived. Oh, like I feel super empowered. Like I know how to cook lots of things. I can make, you know, I have lots of different options for things that I'm comfortable like eating and cooking for myself. And so I feel really lucky to be able to just sort of, you know, have the ability to change my diet in that way and not have it feel like it's a whole bunch of like extra like learning that I have to do or extra work that I wouldn't normally do or something like that, because I kind of already have a skill set that lends itself to me being able to switch up my meal plans pretty easily.
Cool.
So yeah, but yeah, it was nice to get an email. And then maybe we have like one more piece of follow-up. There was something, some pronunciation related like, items like on the agenda.
Talked myself into an awkward spot over the last couple recordings where we were talking, we don't have to retread the whole thing, but talking about James Grant's bartending accolades. And I had mentioned, I had read that he won a very prestigious award that was given to him by, and I didn't know how to say it, and I said Diageo, and then I just dug in and said Diageo about 20 more times. But then of course a very quick internet search. Do you want to know how it's actually pronounced, Shale?
Yeah.
It's pronounced Diageo.
Oh yeah.
Diageo.
That makes
sense.
And it's
a very large beverage company that has some very famous brands like what? Johnny Walker, Tanqueray, Guinness, Bullet Bourbon, stuff like that. Oh, Diageo.
Yeah, Diageo. And they have a like global best bartender competition every year.
That's right. Yep.
I tried looking up their like, I kind of assumed that like they would have on their website like some information about that competition and like a list of past winners and things like that, but I don't know, I looked around and I had some trouble like finding it. The best thing that I could find was like other like food and beverage media writing news stories about winners and things like that, and giving lists of past winners and stuff like that, but I didn't find like anything on their website that was easy to access where you could go and look at past winners.
Oh, interesting.
But there are a few Canadian alumni, like I think in the past like five or 6 years, like three Canadians have won or something.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
One of the winners, she's from Vancouver. I can't remember her name right now, but she has a great TikTok account where she just makes cocktails and
Oh, is it? Oh, cool.
Talks about cocktail making, talks about bartending. Talks a little bit sometimes about the service industry and things like that, but mostly just like does like quick drink recipes and stuff, which is great.
Cool.
I'll put it in the show notes.
I was gonna say. Oh, so that exists. Cool. Well,
yeah, it does exist actually, Alan. I don't know if you've been looking at the show notes in the podcast, but there's tons of links in there in the last like four or five episodes.
Oh, sorry. I meant like, if you said that there's this really great TikTok account, but then didn't let us know how to access it, I would be like, oh,
right, yeah,
okay,
exactly.
So that exists, but I can't access it. Okay. But yeah.
Schrodinger's TikTok account. Yeah. So Diageo. The more you know. Cool. Well, what else are we going to talk about tonight, Alan? Do we have a topic?
Okay. Yeah, we have a premise.
Premise. I like that.
Over the last few years, I occasionally come across menus that are just so have such a bizarre story behind them that caused me to do some reading and research, go down the rabbit hole, as it were. And so I wanted to start sharing some of them with you. And cool. They could be from any time or any place. What I wanted to do was basically just read the menu to you.
Okay.
Get your reaction and talk about it as cooks, and then I'll do my best to explain the menu and reveal some of the context and history behind it. But again, this is kind of like, we say this probably every other recording, like I'm a little bit out of my depth. I'm an amateur student of history. So.
Amateur menu historian.
Although I
will
say,
it amateur menu historian corner.
I will say, like, the first one that I wanted to share today, I've done like a lot of my sources on it are not just Wikipedia. They're from actual written and respectable texts like LaRousse and things like that. So
cool.
But yeah, that's
where do you come across these menus that we're talking about?
Well, that's
you
actually
say you come across them, but what does that mean exactly?
It's usually like, you know what, actually, I wonder if I should just, after we talk about this first menu itself, I can tell you the kind of labyrinthine way by which I came across it.
Okay. I guess there's no, maybe it's different in every case then or something like that.
Well, yeah. So typically what happens is I read one small thing and I go, what does that mean? Or like, I've never heard of that, or who's that? Like, I've never heard of him. And then I'll look that up in LaRousse or online. And then come across eventually some story about a restaurant or an event or whatever.
Right.
And it's not often that a full menu is printed in a text or on a Wikipedia page, but usually online I can rustle it.
Right. So in most cases, internet rabbit holes.
Yeah. Honestly, the first few that I have are not, they all have their origins in looking for something in a real book
right.
or coming across something in a real book. But yeah,
okay,
then the internet jumps in. So I
okay,
think
cool. Well, I'm excited to talk about this first one.
And I'm intentionally not giving you any context. I'm actually going to omit some of the information that's on the menu so that you don't know. It doesn't reveal too much about it. This first one is a menu in the classical sense. So it's not like an a la carte menu. This isn't like a list of everything that you can order from. This is like a set. These are set progressions, set courses that everybody in the dining room is going to eat. And it's in, you'll see, like it's in the classical style, like it's in the age of Escoffier. And so we have a classical French progression. Here's the menu.
Something like a Babette's Feast situation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
There are translations of this menu online, but I've tried to do my own because I'm pretty sure that there are errors in most of the French to English translations, here's mine, and I apologize if there's some errors in mine, but here we go. The hors d'oeuvre is butter, radish, stuffed donkey head, and sardines. The potage, so the soup course, is elephant consomme with red bean toasts, red bean puree on toast.
Okay. Elephant consomme, red bean puree on toast.
Yeah.
Okay.
The entrees are roasted camel à l'anglaise.
Okay.
A civet of kangaroo.
Okay.
And a bear rib roast with sauce poivrade. There's actually another entree here. It's called goujon frites. Goujon, I don't know, is a little fish. I don't know the English word for it, but little small fish, little fried fish. So those are the entrees. And then we're on to the roasts. The roasts are haunch.
Wait, the bear rib roast isn't a roast?
Yeah, you know what? To be honest, in Escoffier-era menus, I don't understand the difference between relevés and entrees and roasts, because sometimes the entrees are roasted. And so I that's actually a nuance that I don't understand. But
yeah, fair enough.
Oh, unless my translation is wrong and it actually means like, it's a bear rib roast. Like that's the cut of meat.
Right.
It's a bear rib roast. So I don't know if it's actually, if the method is roasting. Maybe there's some detail in the language I don't understand. Anyways, so now we're on to the roasts. We have haunch of wolf. So that's the hind leg of a wolf.
Okay.
And it's served in deer sauce.
Okay.
And then we have cat flanked by rats.
What?
And then... some accompaniments to the roast here. We have a watercress salad.
Of course.
We have a terrine of truffled antelope.
Okay.
We have Bordelaise ceps, so mushrooms cooked with red wine, presumably. And we have buttered green peas.
That's one of the accompaniments.
Yes, so one of the sides to the roast. And then on to the entremets, which are like the lighter, like after the roast, they'll serve like the cheese and eggs and some lighter dishes like that. The only entremet here is a rice gâteau with fruit preserves.
Okay.
And then dessert itself in the French style is actually just Gruyère cheese tonight.
A booyah.
Yeah. And then if you're interested, if you're at the first service, your wines tonight are sherry, Latour Blanche, which is a Sauternes, so a sweet white, and Chateau Palmer, which is a Margaux, so a very famous red Burgundy.
Okay.
If you're at the second serving, you're drinking Mouton Rothschild, again, one of the most famous first growth red wines, or like first growth Bordeaux wines. Romanée Conti, one of the most famous white Burgundies. Bellanger Frappé, so a frappé, like a kind of like semi-frozen champagne, and port. Anyways,
okay.
And that's followed by coffee and liqueurs. So that's the menu.
Wow.
There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah. So, I mean... first impressions, it's definitely a game hunter's menu.
But where in the world would they be if they're hunting elephants and camels and kangaroos and antelopes? Yeah. And
yeah, that's the thing. Like every time I heard you say an animal, I was like, oh, okay. So they're in the Middle East, or they're in Australia, or they're in Asia, or they're in Africa. And then I was like, wait, no.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Geez. Wow.
It's to quickly, the entire list of animals on the menu, there was donkey, elephant, those goujons, those little fish.
Yeah.
Camel, kangaroo, bear, wolf, deer,
wolf,
cat,
rats,
antelope, a real menagerie.
Wait, is this a Noah's Ark menu? Yeah, man.
That's not why they brought two of every animal onto the Ark Shield, so that they could eat one of them. That doesn't make any sense.
You need at least two. Oh, man. Yeah, I can't imagine. So, being that it is all over the place, though, like, then it's probably, I would guess that it's probably a menu that's, being served just in some European country wherein they have access to all of these things or mm-hmm. something.
Mm-hmm.
And that they are, yeah, I don't know, bringing them in via some crazy feat of hunting and logistics to have them to be able to serve to like some super high end client
mm-hmm.
or,
oh, okay.
you know, like, or back in the, you know, like, I guess most chefs who would be making fancy meals probably worked for, you know, like not necessarily in a restaurant, but for someone like some aristocrat or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's kind of my guess mm-hmm. is that maybe it's like a private menu from a like a private chef for like either royalty or some kind of aristocratic noble person or mm-hmm. something like that.
Okay, so you've made some very important insights. My question in that scenario, if it were private chef, high profile, maybe nobility, why would they right. serve cat and rats?
That to me, I don't know why, but that to me,
that is the one truly odd.
It definitely stands out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, like, I got a lot of ideas. I mean, it could be because, you know, it's a hunter's meal, and then the cat and the rats are like the hunter and its prey or something. Right. Maybe there's a metaphorical thing there.
Right.
The other thing that occurred to me, and I don't exactly know why, is that maybe that's like a church thing or something. Like,
oh, is it? How do you mean?
Like it's that like a lot of churches were rat infested and cats were like, you know, kept around to like keep the rat infestations under control, mm-hmm. That type of thing. I don't know.
There's another predator prey duo there in the haunch of wolf that's in deer sauce.
Deer sauce. Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think I didn't actually intend to put you on the spot.
I like being put on the spot, though. It's like a fun mystery to try and work out what's happening. I guess, like, maybe if there's some... I kind of want to go through the courses again and talk about them individually,
mm-hmm.
like what I imagine that they would be like or something.
Yeah.
But I guess, like, if there's another hint of information that's on the menu that might give me a little more context, I think that it might be good to have a little more context before trying to talk about the dishes.
Sure. Well, there's at the very top of the menu. I hope this isn't giving too much away, but it says the word menu, and then below that it says the 25th of December, 1870.
Huh.
And then
Christmas.
It says one more, there's one more line right there before it gets into the hors d'oeuvre. I don't know if I'll give too much away.
Don't give that up yet.
Okay.
If you're wondering, then don't.
Okay. So
it's a Christmas menu.
Yeah.
1870 something. That's not that long ago. 150 years.
Yeah.
You want to go through the appetizers?
Yeah. So the hors d'oeuvre was butter, radish, stuffed donkey head, and sardines. Right.
Okay. So it sounds like a chauffeur kind of situation or something.
Oh, yeah. I almost picture it like a, like a galantine made with the boned out head of a donkey.
Right.
So
see, I was, yeah, right. I was, Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I was kind of thinking like that it was potentially a skin off head, but that was like served like with like jellied or something like that.
Oh, okay, bone I see. In. But it does say stuffed.
Yeah. Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, so that's why I was thinking like there's still some preparations like that, like yeah, where especially like with pork typically, like where the head is boned out and then used to wrap around a force meat or something like that. So yeah, totally. I honestly, I don't know exactly what the preparation is exactly. It literally,
no, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Or even if the sardines are incorporated into the stuffing, or if they're right. a garnish, or if they're meant to be their own hors d'oeuvre. Like I can't really picture radishes, butter, the stuffed donkey head and the sardines being incorporated into a single presentation. So I imagine it's like radish and butter, and maybe sardines on toast, and maybe this chauffeur, this kind of terrine
of donkey head.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Yeah, so it's probably like you said like a galantine, and then mm-hmm. sliced and served like in whole slices or something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay,
that's my guess. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. I mean, I don't know if you're just turning it into a lump. I don't know why you have to call it a donkey head, but
that's true. Yeah,
I mean, because it was one, but yeah. Like,
I think for the same reason that you put the wolf and the deer side by side, like because there's something about the spectacle and novelty of this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess in that case, the donkey is the predator and the radishes are the prey.
I didn't take it that far, but you might be right. Yeah.
I think donkeys love radishes.
And then, yeah. So the soup course was elephant consomme.
Right.
Like the literal translation would be puree of red beans. It says au crouton, like croutons, but I'm pretty sure that just means like toast points, like not like the croutons in a Caesar salad in this right, context. Right, yeah. That's what I think.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're like, oh yeah, probably just served on the side of the consomme for like eating with it or something, breaking pieces into it. And
that's a good question. I don't know if it would be served on the side or in the soup. I don't know what the
like probably not in the soup, because you know anything that you put in your consomme is going to
cloud it, like, and make it
cloud it, you know. Yeah. Make it not as so you probably, you know, consommes are often served like at the table, you know, poured over whatever the garnishes are, or, you know, like brought in a bowl, like totally clear with a garnish in the bottom or something. And mm-hmm. then maybe you mm-hmm. have something to like bread or something to eat it with or something. But mm-hmm. yeah, that all makes sense. So yeah, elephant consomme and then red beans. I'm feeling like that's a pretty Asian dish.
Yeah. To me, like it's interesting. So we know that it's in 1870 and like green beans, haricots verts, are like very common on menus.
Right.
Does the word like haricot, does it imply fresh beans? Or there's no way this would be no. dried red beans, would it? Or
no, it could be, yeah, it could be any kind of beans.
So I especially it's in December somewhere in 1870. I had just never seen red beans on a menu of this sort before, and it made me wonder if they were like dried pulses instead of fresh ones.
Right, like probably dried. And like I think the two options are like kidney beans or adzuki beans.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they're calling them red beans.
And to me, like a food historian will listen to this and just laugh us out of the water, but like to me,
please, like, if you're a food historian and you're listening to this podcast, hit us up. Like we need to chat. We'll have you on. Like
dried beans on an haute cuisine menu like this is a bit odd. Like dried beans right. to me is very much a peasant thing, like cassoulet.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah, that's true.
And so I might be reading into it, but I think you'll find across this menu, like say with the rats that we mentioned, the cat and rat, that there's these mm-hmm. slight clues that maybe we're getting low in the pantry, if that makes sense.
Right.
Or like there's no truffles on this menu, for instance. There's no caviar on this menu.
But it is a celebration menu.
Actually, there are truffles. There are truffles on the menu. Sorry, there's the truffled antelope. I apologize. There's no caviar, right, though. And there's these little hints of like, yeah, but that's just that's speculation. It could very well be that there's some manner of fresh red bean that they were eating, because they do have buttered green peas. So they've got produce coming in, even though it's December.
Totally. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I can't even really think of too many kinds of fresh red beans that would be like...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You know. Okay. Elephant consomme. They make that out of one bone or what? Like, I just... It's fascinating to me.
They had more... Well, you'll find out. They had more... They had enough elephant to make... Because usually consomme, like you would have the clear meat, like you make the stock out of knuckle bones or whatever. If you're using veal bones, it'd be like knuckle bones. And then you have the, to clarify it and fortify it, you have the clear meat, which is usually beef shank or some kind of like quite tough, like a cut with a lot of silver skin and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I haven't worked with elephant, but I imagine the same thing. You'd make a stock with your knuckles and other cartilage-rich joints, if there are any.
Right, but those are some big knuckles, Alan. Like, you need a big pot to make that.
Yeah.
Or a really good saw.
Mm-hmm.
Elephant consomme. Moving right along.
So those entrees, the goujon frite, the little fried fish.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, totally.
But like you said, maybe kind of like a lower pantry item. Like, that sounds to me a little bit like, yeah.
It could be
like
actually, so too, sorry.
Like fisherman food or something.
Yeah, sorry, to clarify, I think it's actually not necessarily small fish. Like, it's not like smelts. It's like little strips of fish. So it could be turbot or something, but it's a thin breaded slice that's fried. Still tasty.
Okay. Yeah, I got you.
So yeah, after that we had the roasted camel à l'anglaise. So to be honest, like à l'anglaise means about 100 different things.
Yeah.
Like,
I was wondering about that.
But typically it's almost pejorative, I think, in that it is The insinuation is that the English prepared things very simply compared to the French, right? And so it's usually given to like really like vegetables that are like boiled and then tossed with butter, or like crème anglaise is like a very simple custard. So yeah, I would assume camel roasted à l'anglaise just means like it's salt and pepper and roasted, but I actually don't know the details of it. Or even what cut.
Right.
Is being used.
Like when you're reading out this menu, I was just picturing whole animals.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of like, not really, but
yeah. Cause they do. Well, yeah, I think some of them mention the cut or
the actual cut,
the actual roast. But like, yeah, not for the camel. The next one was the civet of kangaroo. So civet is like a stew. Usually for game meat, and usually I think thickened with the blood of the game animal.
Gotcha.
But otherwise, I don't know anything about the civet of kangaroo.
Okay.
And then we had what I translated as bear rib roast with sauce poivrade, which actually
So this meal, it's meant to represent all the continents, maybe, or something?
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Yeah.
I don't know. Where do cats and rats come from, though? Everywhere. Okay.
And then, yeah, the roasts. So haunch of wolf with deer sauce. Cat.
And I'm assuming that's just like the deer sauce is probably just like a reduction of deer stock, like something like that. Is that...
Yeah, that's another one. Like, that's obviously not a classical, like, you can't look up what does sauce chevreuil mean, like, what does deer mean? So it could be a reduction sauce. It could also wondered if it was just like a almost like a loose stew, like if it had some of the meat, like some deer meat in it. But I really don't know.
Fair. Okay. Wolf sounds stringy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, yeah, then it was the cat flanked by rats.
Cat flanked by rats. It's got to be a metaphor. It's a loaf of bread that's baked in the shape of a cat, and the rats are, I don't know.
It's not. And then we had our water.
I mean, nothing against eating rats. I mean, yeah. I kind of have a problem with eating cats, but that's just because of my pet bias.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, man, that does not sound, to me, does not sound good.
Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, everybody has, yeah, we both know that there's cultures where rats are eaten, but, and yeah, it's whatever, it, just different. We obviously come from a different time and place, and for us, it's kind of a taboo. And
I just like with the rat thing, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it'd be like perfectly fine to eat rats if you could find rats that didn't just live off of like garbage,
right?
And you know, live in really filthy, dirty places. So, mm-hmm. you know, rats that live in the forest? Are there forest rats, Alan? You know, like that's probably,
I don't know.
It's, yeah. Well, I imagine that there are, like, yeah.
They, as far as I know, they might be completely in a symbiotic relationship with humans. I don't know. They might,
I mean,
live
I think maybe
lives.
They are, but like, they're also like, like I know in a lot of Southeast Asian countries, like they kill and eat them because they're pests agriculturally.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So, yeah, like I know for sure. I watched a documentary about it, actually.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
It was a few years ago and I don't exactly remember. But yeah, there were like people smuggling rats over the border between Vietnam and Cambodia or something like that. Oh, I think maybe it was a Bourdain episode. Ah, I can't remember.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But do you mean,
but yeah.
Like to introduce them as pests?
No, like to sell them as meat.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. 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 So they like people were like killing them. Like catching them and killing them and then taking them to the neighboring country selling them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
What else you got?
And then we had our watercress salad.
Right. Sorry, does that come with the cat and the rats?
Well, like, I don't think it would be put on the same plate, but it, like, it's listed as
they're sides and they all come with the roasts.
So, yeah, right? I think that there are only two roasts proper. There's the wolf and the cat. And then we have these kind of accompaniments. So the watercress salad, the terrine of truffled antelope, the Bordelaise seps, and the buttered green peas.
Man.
And then from there on, the menu gets
much
more conventional and appetizing the rice gâteau, which I think is like almost like a set rice pudding.
Right.
Yeah, makes sense. With fruit preserves and Gruyere cheese.
Like set so much that you could like slice it, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Like it would be like rice cooked in milk and then... like how you have eggs or maybe like you would add egg yolks and sugar to it, to the cooked rice and milk. Then fold in whipped egg whites and then bake it in if it's called a gâteau, it's probably like baked in one of those big, like a charlotte mold or whatever, in a bain-marie and sliced, I think.
Sounds interesting. I don't think I've ever had anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've had like plenty of like cakes that are made out of like rice flour and stuff like that, but
right, yeah,
nothing like that.
It could be, I don't actually know, but just because I've read this menu for so long, that could be another glimpse into the state of relative poverty that these people are experiencing.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking was the other thing on the menu that sounded pretty peasant like to me was mm-hmm. the rice gâteau.
Mm-hmm. Whereas like the equivalent in Babette's Feast would be the rum baba, which obviously is made with like high processed wheat flour and has rum
right.
and So I think you've made some really important insights and guesses. Is there any other specifics you want to guess? Like, do you want to guess the country or the city? Or we told you that it's in 1870.
Yeah,
you've guessed that it's probably for some manner of prestigious clientele.
I mean, I think anything that I would be guessing at this point would kind of be a shot in the dark. Like, I have some sort of like contextual ideas, but like, you know, as for actually making a guess, like, I don't know, it's pretty, I don't really feel like I have anything that informs like where exactly it would have been made and for whom. Yeah, I mean, like, you're obviously translating it from French,
right?
So it's probably in France.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It is, although I will say, like, even if this had been served in Canada in 1870, a meal like this, the menu would be entirely in French. Sorry, like, I mean, outside of French-speaking Canada, because this
right.
was, like, this
because it's a French meal.
It's
a,
yeah, right. exactly, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you that the last bit of information on the menu that I withheld from you.
Okay, so yeah, let's hear it.
The menu reads, menu, 25th of December, 1870, the 99th day of the siege.
Okay, so yeah, you've definitely backed me into a corner now wherein I don't know anything about historical context.
No, and sorry, I'm not looking for you to name the city or the battle or whatever, but that is the tension we're talking about.
It helps contextualize like the idea that, you know, that the larder is basically empty at this point and that potentially they're like, I don't know, like killing working animals to make a meal or something like that.
Yeah. And that's more or less what's happening. 1870 and 1871 was the Franco-Prussian War.
Okay.
In which...
Which is what? That's a precursor to the First World War, is that right? Or is it
in
like
a
too
way,
far?
It's,
yeah,
it's,
in a way.
I mean, not directly, but it's part of the... colonial and successionary squabbling that happened throughout Europe in after
right.
the French Revolution and yeah, I guess culminated in the First World War. But it the Franco-Prussian War was a fairly embarrassing one for France. The Prussians, Kaiser Wilhelm and Otto von Bismarck, just were far superior to the French militarily. And they ended up laying siege to Paris for several months.
Right.
I think it started in the fall. Oh, yeah. I mean, if we're at Christmas and it's the 99th day of the siege, the siege started in the fall.
Right.
And things got very desperate in the city to the point where people were catching stray animals in the streets just to have something to eat. But so the flip side of this is we're in 1870, which is like... basically, you know, one of the golden ages of the start of the golden age of classical cuisine. And so there's one of the most famous restaurants in Paris is called Voisin, and it has a very famous chef named Choron. And they still have wealthy clientele who want to eat at this exclusive restaurant. But it's very hard for them to get stuff into the city.
Right.
And I've never...
But it's easy for them to get an elephant?
Well, okay, so I've never heard it described this way, but I think that in like for a lot of people, this menu was a two birds, one stone kind of situation where, yes, people are starving, but also the zookeepers are having trouble feeding their animals.
Right.
And so,
oh yeah.
So this restaurant bought up a bunch of exotic animals from a zoo in Paris. And one of those purchases was for their two elephants, which were named Castor and Pollux. and so there's menu that we have the elephant consomme on this menu, but I believe that like throughout the season, they worked on serving, these two elephants at the restaurant. And so you can find other menus from this restaurant in that during the siege where they're serving like elephant trunk in chasseur right. sauce and stuff like that. But yeah, so all of these animals, the donkey, elephant, camel, kangaroo, bear, wolf, and the rest, were purchased from a zoo, and sent to the abattoir and then brought to Voisin where Choron cooked them.
Wow.
Which is just such a, like, it's so strange because like you, on the one hand, you have a city under siege where there's people starving in the streets. It's not exactly clear to me what the state of the nobility would be. Like if they're
right
a little bit put out, but still eating fine every day. But this gives you some idea. Like it's hard to tell what there's some tongue in cheek stuff on the menu, like the cats and rats and wolves and deer put side by side. And they mention that it's the 99th day of the siege on the menu. So I don't know if it's like all a laugh for them and they're just like, this is like a totally
right.
ridiculous, hilarious thing that this restaurant's doing.
Or right, like go on and siege us. We're just going to have a meal right. made of elephant. You
right.
know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Like I don't know how much desperation there would have been in the people cooking and eating this menu. I have absolutely no concept. Like if it was just a gimmick or
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, seems like maybe not that much desperation, you know, like if you're
yeah.
taking the time to, you know, to even cook this meal, you have to pay the people who are, you know, like, who are cooking this meal probably in food and,
right.
you know,
yeah.
things like that. And so, yeah, it seems pretty, like, sheltered or removed from the reality of the situation
mm-hmm.
or something like that. But, mm-hmm. but yeah, hard to know, I guess.
It must be mostly
man, that's
a
fascinating.
Yeah, it's so
what's that?
Weird. I think it, on some level it must be mostly a joke.
Right.
Or a gimmick. But yeah, I don't know.
But then also probably, you know, like Choron probably took a great deal of pride in having one of the, you know, most renowned restaurants in Paris and you mm-hmm. know probably took a, you know, put a great deal of effort into making this like, you know, what is yeah, like you said, kind of tongue in cheek. But probably, you know, still really tried to make something amazing, do something like over, above and beyond, like, you know, like.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. And, wow.
And so getting to that name Choron, when you asked earlier, like, how do I come across these menus generally, but this one in particular, mm-hmm. I was studying to challenge the Red Seal exam. And so
okay.
I was going back and memorizing this list of classical sauces.
Classical preparations, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, not just sauces, but that's where I was doing sauces that day. And I found like for when they're taught in culinary school, the actual meaning behind the names of the sauces is not usually apparent or revealed. But I found it helped
right.
me remember much better if I knew, like,
had some context.
Yeah, exactly. So, for instance, like a sauce maltese, that means sauce from Malta. But what does that? That
right.
doesn't mean anything to
right.
to most of us. But if you read, like, oh, it's called a Maltese sauce because it's made with blood oranges. It's like a Hollandaise sauce that has blood orange puree in it. And Malta used to be famous for its blood oranges. So then it's like just
right.
helps, I don't know, flesh it out a little bit in my memory. And so there's a famous, or like a classical sauce called sauce Chauhan. And it's a, what is it? It's like a béarnaise sauce with tomato paste in it or something.
Okay.
And I was like, well, what does Chauhan mean? Like, what is it? And of course he has an entry in La Russe Gastronomique, and they mention the elephant trunk right in his, it's like what he's
wow, really?
After the sauce. And I think maybe some other garnish that he invented, it's the elephant, and that's what kind of, and then you can, yeah, exactly. Go down the rabbit hole and read about the restaurant and then read about this bizarre service. And if you go online, you can see the full menu.
Crazy. So is there any indication of who ate the menu?
There are, there's accounts of people who, I don't know, there must be accounts from people who ate this particular, like who were there this evening. But I definitely read accounts from correspondents and journals and stuff of people who tried the elephant at Voisin. Most were not impressed, by the way. For the trunk, anyways.
I mean,
I don't know about the consommé, but the trunk did not go over very well.
I can't imagine. Like, it's got to be, well, I guess it would have to be braised. I don't know. Like, I can't even imagine how I wouldn't know where to start. Like, I mean, you'd be cutting it into steaks, I guess, right? Like rings or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then I'm sure it's very, like, you know, I'm sure it's very tough muscle.
Like, I picture it like an enormous oxtail. But I really have no idea. Like, it's kind of like...
Yeah, but I don't think it has like bones in it in the same way that oxtail does.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't know 100%. I don't know a ton about elephant physiology, but I think it's like, yeah, I think it's like muscle and skin and like...
Huh. Okay, I'll look
tendons into that. And no bones. Yeah. And so then I'm like picturing like cutting it into like rounds, but then I would imagine that you would have to braise them, but then you would, you know, like, and you would also have to skin them, because I can't imagine elephant skin, it could be anything that would, you know, could be edible. Mm-hmm. Just can't picture it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. Obviously I have no idea.
Yeah. Fascinating. And then, so do you have any other, like, I guess you don't have any other information about how any of the dishes were prepared, hey? From your rabbit hole diving?
No, really, the only clues, and it's possible that the information is out there, but the only clues that I had really are those, the words from classical cuisine that I can, that I either know or can look up.
Right.
So, like, that civé, like, knowing that it's a stew, so there'd be, like... Typically, it would be for a game animal. You would marinate the meat in white wine. In wine, not white wine. And then, strain it off, sear it, use that wine from the marinade to prepare the stew, and then to thicken the liquid with some of the blood.
The blood.
Because that's such a specific preparation, I assume that they stayed fairly true to that for the kangaroo, but I don't have any other details outside of
it. I also like it. It's fascinating to me, you know, like when you, if you like are buying all these animals from the zoo, mm-hmm. you have to break them all down and store them all somehow.
Mm-hmm.
If they bought two elephants.
Yeah.
It's a lot. Like, I don't know. It's just logistically, I'm thinking about it. It sounds like a real interesting logistical problem to try and solve.
Yeah. There's a lot of that, like from this, this is kind of a tangent, but like, so Escoffier was cooking at this time. He wasn't anywhere near the like heights of his fame and reputation, but he was a chef in Paris, and he fought in the Franco-Prussian War, or he was enlisted or conscripted into the Franco-Prussian War as a cook.
Right.
And he cooked for French officers. And in his biography, they show you the menus and talk a lot about his time during the war. And they were like, they would have like they would be carrying live animals around with them, and he would like find a pig in a village, and they would take it with them until they needed it, and then they would kill it and process it.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering is like, you know, maybe you purchase them from the zookeeper, but then they stay at the zoo until you need them or something. Mm-hmm. But there's so many different animals in this particular menu that I'm just like,
yeah, I think that they must have like, if I had to guess, if we talk about like, maybe this is not really such a desperate time for the wealthy, if just for, you know, the 2 or 4 weeks of the holiday season, this restaurant was packed with all of the wealthiest Parisians and they're cooking like this every night, possibly.
Then you could go through a lot pretty quickly, I guess. But yeah. Yeah. Wow. Fascinating. I've heard some descriptions of some pretty crazy menus. Like there's some descriptions of some crazy menus in like one of Ruhlman's books or maybe in a couple of them. Is that in Soul of a Chef where he talks about like the Roman meal where they like stuffed a camel with a horse with a pig with a down to like a pheasant and put a truffle inside or something?
I've heard of that. I don't know. I wouldn't have thought that was in Soul of a Chef, but I don't actually know.
I can't remember. I'm pretty sure it's in one of Ruhlman's books where he's talking about it, and I can't remember the context exactly. It might be Making of a Chef. Maybe he's talking about it in anyway. Yeah. I've heard about stuff like that, like, you know, crazy classical cuisine and stuff, but yeah, that I've never heard of anything like that before. That's pretty fascinating.
Just so odd and hard to imagine.
Yeah, like the circumstance. Like now that you're talking about it, it totally makes sense. It probably should have occurred to me that it was a zoo menu.
I was worried when I said that it was a veritable menagerie that I was
right that you'd given your you'd given up the hand, game. Yeah. Oh man, I was so close with Noah's Ark.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like right on the right track.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Well, I mean, I guess if we ever really get in a tight spot.
We have a blueprint, is that what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. If there's a zombie apocalypse, we can just lock ourselves into the zoo. If you had to pick one dish off that menu to make, like the thing that's the most fascinating to you or something, like, or that you think that you would learn something from actually going through the process of like making it.
The funny thing is that I think when I started cooking, I had such a narrow, like I grew up on such a narrow selection of proteins, like chicken, beef, pork, that when I first started cooking and heard about something like rabbit or veal or
or bison
pheasant.
Ribeye.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, that sounds crazy. Like I can't believe people eat that even. The truth is that at the end of the day, like the first time I ate rabbit, it did not taste so unique and different to me. And I think the biggest difference, even like beef to bison, the biggest differences in meat for me, like species to species, have had more to do with like whether it's actually farmed or truly wild.
Right.
Like,
more dietary than, and like,
yeah. Like for instance, like beef and farmed beef and farmed bison, conventionally farmed beef and bison, don't taste strikingly different to me, but farmed beef and true wild venison taste quite a bit different. But honestly, to me, like the wild deer that I've had tastes rather similar to a lot of the pastured lamb that I've had before, like entirely grass-fed and finished lamb. And even some of the grass-fed and finished nouveau beef, like beef that's killed at this, like at, I don't know what it is, at 8 months or something.
Yeah.
So in terms of like the cooking, I don't know which of these dishes like would have anything to reveal about technique. Do you know what I mean? Like the technique for the consommé doesn't, it almost doesn't matter what the protein is.
No, yeah, totally.
But certainly in breaking down the animals, I guess there would be something to be learned. But the one that I would want to try, that I would be the most excited to try, is a truffled terrine of antelope. Like, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah. I'm pretty curious about the donkey's head, too.
Yeah. I didn't look, actually, if there... So, like, the... That the specific French language, like tête d'âne farci, like head of donkey stuffed. I didn't look to see, like, maybe that is a more standard term. Like, maybe there's tête de veau farci or something, and we could see what what the preparation is. I could look in.
Right. That. Oh, yeah. And farci probably means that, like, they're, yeah, like you said, they're probably, like, deboning it and then taking out a lot of the meat and turning that into a farce and then stuffing it back in. And that all makes sense. That tracks. Yeah. I mean, I've never really, I've made head terrines before. But yeah, not very often. And I don't think I've used the actual head ever. I think made a terrine out of the content, but didn't actually use the skin to stuff it back into.
Oh, sorry. Like I see. That. Yeah. Cause I do think that like without that word stuff, without the word farci, like tête de veau, like veal head, I think is like head cheese. I think that is a fairly normal preparation. That's just like the head cheese we would make with pork. So like a gelatin bound.
And Gruyere for dessert. Where'd they get the Gruyere from? I thought they were under siege.
I don't know if it's
just Gruyere everywhere.
But like if it's real aged Gruyere,
growing up out of the ground,
then maybe they just have it in a cellar aging. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
In a cave in the middle of Paris somewhere.
Or if like because Switzerland is neutral in everything, maybe they're allowed to bring in Swiss cheese. I don't know. I don't know.
Ugh. It's good, Alan. Pray you never have to eat that many.
Yeah.
Pray we're never under siege from the Prussians.
So that was, that was the first one I wanted to share with you because I had done enough reading to be able
to contextualize it.
Exactly, to be able to explain it. I don't think we have time to do another one. Or you think it's marginal?
I think that was fun though. I would really like to do another one at some point. I'm curious. Was that like, is that your favorite? Did you put your favorite first and like?
This is like the first one that I came upon where I was like, I need to talk about this with someone someday because most people in my waking life don't want to hear about any of this. Right. So this is the one I've been the most eager to share because I've had it with me for such a long time.
Right.
The next one that I want to do, I'll give you a little teaser. This is not all Escoffier stuff. The next one is probably equally as odd. And we're going from France, from Paris under siege in 1870, all the way to fascist Italy. So I'll give you that.
Great. Oh, man. Yeah. This is, okay. Well, I'm excited. I mean, we're not going to do it next episode, but I think, man, that's great.
What's the name of the segment?
Amateur Menu Historian Corner.
Needs a few more words in it, I think.
Man, it's so embarrassing when I'm watching Jeopardy with people and there's like a category that's about food and I get some of the questions wrong. Oh, that's the worst.
for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.